Welcome to Blocked and Reported. I'm Jesse Single, and joining me today, while Katie Herzog comparison shops conversion therapy clinics for herself, is PSA Sitch, Sitch for short. Sitch, thank you for joining us.
I would say thanks for having me, but this has been an ordeal. Oh my God. You know, I've been on a lot of shows, and never before have I been given so much homework, Jesse. This is ridiculous.
I asked Sitch to record a brief audio thing to check his quality. It was 10 seconds of kvetching that he had to record for 10 seconds.
No, listen. No. Don't listen to Jesse's lying, okay? He's like, record your audio for me. Send it to me. Do a book report on what you want to talk about. Send it to me. Here's my taxes. Can you do my taxes? Oh, here's a list of escort services. Can you, you know, which one of these should I use? Which is safe to use?
I was like, Sitch, I can't explain this. I need a dick pic with the MP3. I need to get the levels right on the dick pic, the color saturation. Thank you for sending that. We had this whole thing planned out today. I want to talk about your work, but let's briefly jump right into something I know our audience is interested in. Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating trajectories among online, shall we say, personalities, Brianna Wu. Brianna Wu, you're a streamer. I'm already doing everything out of order. I haven't introduced you yet. You're a streamer. you and Adam friended, Sitch and Adam show. Mm-hmm. You had Brianna Wu on, and you told me before we started recording, it was actually a normal, productive conversation. You're about the 12th person who has told me Brianna Wu has taken this incredibly disturbing turn toward being a normal human being. Tell me about your stream and what happened.
Well, we've had her on a couple times. We also had Anna Kasparian on, who's a big fan of our show, by the way.
She one time defended me, which I think is disgraceful.
Wow.
So I
okay.
will not say that. I will not. I refer to her as A star, A K star star S P star.
Of course.
Yeah, she's
the
worst.
She will not be named. But I know. So we had Brianna on a couple of times, and you know, I thought it was obviously we don't agree on everything. There's still a lot of disagreement, but she's moving in an interesting direction. A lot because of the Israel situation, which I think has opened a lot of people's eyes on the left to finally being aware that there is a contingency of people in the movement that are crazy and need to be expunged.
And you think that was sort of her... Because she's also gotten in some trouble for saying relatively mild things about like gender dysphoria and trans stuff, right?
Yeah, actually, she did sort of go on this trajectory a little earlier because when we were talking to her about this, she said it was because she did work in actual politics and kind of saw how the sausage was made, and then, you know, has to now deal with the internet activist community and realizes that there's a pretty large disconnect between them and reality.
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, I don't want to talk much about trans stuff. We hit it too much, but like there's a very big divide between... This is true with any group of people. If you talk to just a normal offline trans person, what they think about XYZ versus what the most online activists think. I think maybe Brianna ran into that a little, and same deal with Israel. But I'm glad to hear that she's like, I don't know, doing better. Is that condescending to say?
I guess. I mean, you have some sordid past with her. I don't know if you want to bring it up here. But.
Yeah. I mean, I think our listeners are well aware, but I feel, how do I phrase this diplomatically? Well, I want like a Camp David Accords with her. We need to get back to the table. I will say that I have felt misrepresented by her. And also she DM'd Katie long before Katie and I were friends, saying that mm-hmm. I set up interviews with trans women just like that I wasn't going to use for my journalism just because I was so desperate to talk to them. Like, don't get me wrong, I am extremely lonely, but I would never...
Like, she was accusing you of being a chaser.
So, like, right now, we're not recording this. I just needed someone to talk to for a couple hours. So I do that, but I don't focus on trans people in general, is the point.
Right, right.
Anyway, Brianna Wu, interesting trajectory. I hope you'll continue to monitor it and report back. We have a few stories we want to get to today, covering topics ranging from fat people to kids who are bad or good at math to protesters and tampons. But first, I just want to more fully introduce you to the BarPod audience. I became aware of you maybe 5 or 6 years ago. You have this great channel, still have, which published these really smart, funny videos. You covered a wide range of stuff, some cultural criticism. You had a brutal takedown of the way Game of Thrones wrapped itself up. You had some straightforward explainers on subjects like Gamergate, some political commentary. These days, you're spending a lot more of your time streaming with Adam Friended, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So this is your channel, the Sitch and Adam Show. We'll include a link to it in the show notes. This is a lame question, but I'm genuinely curious. All I know about you is you're a Florida Jew, and your dick pics have great lighting. I take it you're in the, like, not too far from age 30 in one direction or the other. Is that true?
Yeah, let's leave it that. I like that. That's a good way of talking about it.
I guess none of us are too far from 30 in a cosmic sense. Like, we're all pretty close to 30.
We're, like, too old to be on the internet, but, like, young considered to most, like, normal people.
Yeah, you've got sort of an authoritative... I feel like your voice is older than your age, if that makes sense. You've got, like, that good sort of radio voice, but...
I think I have the worst voice ever.
Really? I mean, I did too, and I'm a fucking professional podcaster now, so...
I guess compared to you.
Wow, all right. Well, go fuck yourself. Thanks for... the reason I ask is I think you're a little younger than me. And when I was sort of coming of age and learning about politics and becoming a fascist, all that, there wasn't anything like being a YouTube content creator who makes what are in effect video essays. I mean, some of your stuff is very long and very detailed and requires a lot of research. What were your sort of influences growing up that first led you to carve out that niche on YouTube?
The thing that made me start YouTube was actually, so I wrote a book and I couldn't get it published. This was a fictional book.
Called Twilight.
It was called Twilight. No, actually, she stole it. Okay, I wrote the original Twilight. But so I was like, okay, well, I can't get this book published. And they're like, oh, you need to get your own audience. I'm like, I thought that's what the publisher's for. I need to get my own. What am I paying you for? So I basically was like a lot of people. I was on the left for most of my life. I consider myself a liberal for most of my life. And somewhere around 2014, 2015, 2016, it seemed like there was some part of the left that was kind of going insane, and the mainstream didn't really want to talk about it or deal with it. And I was like, what's going on here? And it was very weird. It was very puritanical. This was kind of the beginning of cancel culture. And it seems like for younger people, this might be like a complete shock to them. But you know, me way back in 2014, 2015, I always grew up with the idea that it was the right that was the one that was like morally policing everyone, that was canceling speech. It was always the left that was like the freedom party of speech, giving everyone, you know, the opportunity to speak and discuss ideas. So this was like a completely wacky thing that seemed like I didn't even understand what was going on, like a lot of people in that time period. And so I saw a lot of people talking about this on the internet, and I said, hey, I think I'm a smart, funny, egotistical, internet niche micro celebrity individual. I should start a YouTube channel so people can listen to my thoughts about this. And then maybe I can sell a book years later, which I've now completely forgotten to do.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Wait, what kind of fiction? What can you tell me about that?
Don't worry about it. Listen, I'll come back to it sometime. I'll finish it up. I'll hawk it to my audience. I'll give you a signed copy. Okay.
So this is all just a giant scam. This whole, like, becoming an established internet personality because you have a book about, like, probably some dragon or something.
Yes, the dragon who wants to foil communism, yes.
Just flying over the USSR, historical fiction.
Exactly.
Okay, so you had a very specific goal in mind, and that goal combined with this really weird era in American politics, and... you made these videos, and they're excellent. I'm going to include links to some of the show notes. And then how did you link up with Adam and start the streaming thing?
So it's actually funny. I don't even remember. I think Adam just, like, reached out to me. He saw one of my videos, and like you, he's like, this video's genius. This person must be really intelligent. You know, I tricked him just like I'm tricking you right now. But so he asked me to, like, come on, and we talked for a bit, and we hit it off, and we were, you know, had good chemistry. And so we just started streaming, and I was like, hey, why am I wasting all my time spending hours and hours and hours editing, painstakingly editing, maybe even over-editing these videos when I could just be streaming for a lot more money? It's a lot less work.
And does it work out to a lot more money for less work?
It 100% does.
Oh, man. I guess that makes sense because you're producing so much more content, but I have danced around the edges of streamer drama mostly through, I think, mutual buddy Destiny.
Mm-hmm. And he's not really mutual buddies, but okay.
He's not. Wait, I thought you guys, have you been on, what's your relationship to Destiny? Are you enemies?
No. So, I mean, I know, I don't, I like some of his takes. It's weird because we have a lot of positional overlaps, But the last conversation we have, I just felt like he was like hyper unfair to me and Adam in the conversation for like, I don't know why. I think to me, I thought it was a conversation, but I think to him, it was pitched as a debate. And so he just like went into it like hyper aggressive debate brained. And it's just like I think it was like a terrible conversation. He said some crazy shit in the conversation. So I don't know. Even though I still like a lot of his takes, you know, I just, that interaction was not, was not a good one.
Wait, is PSA Sitch a pseudonym for Jordan Peterson? Is that what this
is? It is.
Wow.
Yeah. That was the conversation. Yeah.
I'm hoping to like, we'd obviously like all podcasts would like more listeners. So I'd like to give you an opportunity on the record to call Destiny a racial slur. Do you have any interest in doing that?
Well, I believe, according to Hassan and some of the other people, I'm allowed to call him a Gusano. How do you say it?
Oh, Gusano. Do you know the origin of that word?
It's, I believe it is like a word for worm.
Yeah.
In Cuban revolutionary speak.
Yeah. So, yeah, Fidel era Cuba, you're a Gusano if you leave to go to America for a better life. But they also have an amazing compound word that mixes Gusano and compañero, Gusanero. So that's like a warm comrade, like someone you still like, even though they're Gizmero. Spanish is a great language. Okay, so in certain ways, your guys' format almost reminds me of like, I came up, I would do drives between Boston and Michigan for when I was in my last years of college. I would, to stay awake, listen to the most insane right-wing talk radio, Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, shit like that. I'm not comparing you guys to that, but
I was
going to
say, what's going on here?
I was going to say, they were way smarter than you and Adam, and you guys are much bigger reactionaries, but it always struck me as a feat to sit behind a mic, whatever your politics, and just talk for 3 hours, and your guys' streams go 6, 7, 8 hours. How do you do that?
Well, there's two ways, because first of all, I agree. I don't know how someone just does it by themselves. I can't just go on and on and on and on and on and on for like 3 hours. So it's me and Adam. So we're bouncing off of each other. We're, you know, going on. We're going off on all these tangents and all this stuff. But also, so the thing that we do is that we usually find one or two video essays, my old job, that are generally terrible. And we'll cover them and we'll kind of rip them to shreds and critique them and go through all the things that got wrong, all the bad things that they said, or we'll cover debates. You know, there's these super long debates that are like 1-2 hours that we'll go through. And so obviously to do all that critiquing takes hours and hours and hours. So I think it's actually far easier to do that than to do the just talk to yourself for 3 hours model.
Yeah. And so you guys will take, I mean, I was looking at some of your recent stuff. You had one where you're just, you guys are breaking down like members of the audience, like the Peterson Destiny debate, right?
Yes.
There seems to be such an appetite for streamer drama. I noticed this when, I think you guys covered this too. My one sort of foray into the streaming stuff was when I called into Majority Report.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly there's like five videos from high account channels, including yours. Some pro me, some anti way, breaking it down almost frame by frame. It seems like there's this huge appetite just for the drama itself and for pointing out why people are dumb, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, the streaming model for a lot of people is to stream every day for 4 to 8 hours every day. We usually just do a long stream on Sunday, and we've been experimenting, though we were off last week, but we've been experimenting doing news stories streams every day for like 1 or 2 hours. But most people, they just stream as long as possible every day. That's where the big bucks are. And so they're always looking to just, you know, for that juicy drama that you're talking about, that content that they can kind of watch and give context to their audience. Because, you know, it's easier to do that.
It's also interesting because Katie and I were sort of arguing about Candace Owens. So Katie referred to her as a liability because she's so, what's the word I'm looking for? Crazy, batshit insane, deranged. Again, to put it diplomatically. And I put it out to Katie, like, I don't think that's a liability. I think it all redounds to her benefit to be crazy. So I think about some of these guys, like a Vosh or a Hassan, the folks at the very top of it. I'll occasionally come across a scandal, a quote-unquote scandal, where they've apparently embarrassed themselves or had a little bit of a meltdown. But it seems like the ultimate expression of like any publicity is good publicity. I think it always just brings more people into their orbit, right? Unless they like, you know, kill someone on stream.
I think it depends on what the crazy is. Because if you look at someone like Hassan, he'll say or do crazy things that his audience likes. You know, he said America deserved 9/11. He had someone who's claiming to be a Houthi pirate on his show. He Yeah, he interviewed him and he asked him about like anime. He didn't ask him anything like legitimate about the what about the hostages that you're holding there? Maybe you shouldn't be, you know, shooting rockets at people. So that could help. I don't know if I haven't been keeping up on the drama. I don't know what Vosh's channel is doing after the porn drama happened, because I don't know if his community really appreciates lolly porn or not. So I don't know if that's going to end up helping him or not. But regarding Candace, the thing about Candace that I don't like is that she is...
Wait, there's something about Candace Owens you don't like, you're saying?
It's just one. I mean, I think she's like just one the thing, best yeah. person in the entire world, but she has one thing that kind of irks me. And it's that she doesn't hate you enough. Okay.
Yeah.
No, it's that... So Candace is... It's hard to tell whether she's like a grifter, whether she's crazy or what's going on here. And I'm sure you talked about all of her amazing backstory with Social Autopsy and all that stuff to your audience. So I'm not going to go over that. But she has this very good knack and this ability to take a story that people are covering and to frame it in the most incendiary, extreme, one-sided, red meat, get her audience riled up way as humanly possible. She's just so good at doing that and presenting it to her audience. And to me, I'm like, listen, I want to be a moderate here. I want everyone to calm down. I want to chill. I want understanding on both sides of the aisle. And she's over there with like the gasoline revving everybody up.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad she broke the story that Emmanuel Macron's wife is a dude, because I would not have known that. I was sort of into her. I mean, I think she has a certain type of undeniable social intelligence or maybe intuition that is a little bit similar to Trump, in that you could not get Trump to explain in coherent language what a tax is, for example. But if you get him in front of the right crowd, he can do a very compelling rant about how evil taxes are, or the immigrants poison. Like, he can develop an audience by understanding what they want and giving him that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense. You know, I do wonder, though, if, you know, she was kind of attacked by Zoe Quinn way back in the day, and then she became right wing. You know, I wonder now that she's had this falling out with the Daily Wire, is she going to, like, do you think she's going to go even further? She's like, oh, I was attacked by the Daily Wire, and, you know, I'm going to become, like...
Heil Hitler!
Yeah, like, friends, right? Alt-right people, I have no clue what's going to happen. A friend of mine thinks that she's gonna come out and suddenly be like, oh, I was brainwashed by the right, and she's going to go full left-wing again, but I'm kind of skeptical of that.
No, I think she has made so much money and become so famous because of her embrace by the right. I think she's just going to get crazier and crazier. It's like, to a certain extent, the Daily Wire, not that I don't think they employ crazy people or say crazy things, but they've got a foot in like semi-respectable conservatism. And I think that sort of anchors her. And without that anchor, she's just going to drift away. Like, she's going to provide blocked and reported content for years. Let's just say that.
I mean, just for the content, I hope she does go full Kanye, because it would be pretty funny. God,
poor Kanye. how do you guys sort of, maybe you don't think about it this way, but tell me how you, I have trouble in my writing and my podcasting striking the right balance, because if I simply wanted to maximize engagement and subscribers and money, there's a few subjects I would cover forever. And I would do so in a very sort of emotional way. You have carved out a reputation as like a rational, moderate, thoughtful dude. But do you ever feel sort of tempted by the dark side, especially given how much crazy shit is always going on in the streaming world?
So you're the only person that thinks that that's how we're categorized. besides our audience, everyone that doesn't like us either categorizes us as like evil secret right-wing grifters who
well, hold on, I haven't looked at your page in a while. Let me just typing why the Holocaust didn't happen. Oh, I should have looked at your most recent stuff before inviting
exactly,
you on.
Exactly. But yeah, so either we're categorized as like secret evil right-wing grifters or secret evil like left-wing grifters. Like both the extremes on both sides seem to hate our guts. So, but to answer your question, the way that I deal with it is I don't, this isn't going to be a good answer, but the answer is I just don't think about it. Yeah. It's just depressing. Because you're right. Like, I know, everyone on the internet knows that if you go in certain directions, if you cover certain things in specific ways, it's going to help you grow an audience. And I just try not to think about it just so that temptation doesn't even occur to me.
I mean, you do. I feel like I've attracted some audience from being the rational, it's complicated guy. But it's like there's clearly a bigger audience out there if you discard that. Okay, let me get to, before we move on to the meat of the show, I asked Twitter for some questions for you. Let's see here. Well, this is related, but I'm actually curious to hear your answer. Matthew Myers asked, at what point does criticism of culture war issues move from being meaningful critique to sensationalism? I occasionally enjoy Sitchin Adams' discussion, shots fired, but sometimes I worry they focus on the crazy shit that only happens on the fringes of the left.
So the way that I look at it is if you do content where all you do is you hyperfixate on one side of the aisle doing like weird or crazy things, and then not only do you focus on that, but then you make general statements like, this is what all the left is doing, this is what all the right is doing. I think, to me, that's how you enter into that territory where I feel like you're being dishonest, you're just over-sensationalizing things. And I feel like, even if we do cover, you know, because we do try to cover like wacky things, though I do try to, when we're doing like more newsy stuff, I do try to find the stories that I think people are, on either one side or the other, are misrepresenting to kind of get to the truth of it. But I feel like whenever we cover stuff, you know, me and Adam are very careful to be like, this is not indicative of everyone. This is the, you know, extremists. These are the internet people. The average mainstream, you know, person or even the average mainstream politician doesn't like fully engage or even remotely understand this internet political culture war thing that's happening right now.
Yeah. I've had a lot of trouble because like in the US, the median Democratic voter is very much a normie. I mean, that's why Joe Biden won. And people, I think, especially conservatives, don't really want to believe that. Like, they just sort of reject that out of hand because there is a strain of sort of some radicalism in the Democratic Party often. I think it's sort of like, it's a little bit boring if you're a culture warrior to acknowledge that most people are normies, but it seems like an important thing to realize.
Well, one of the big problems that I see with politics is that the way it works is the both sides. So the left will look at the craziest people on the right, they'll pull them out, they'll do a bunch of news stories about them, and then they'll paint the entire right with this broad brush saying, this is everyone on the right. And then the right...
QAnon is sort of an interesting example of that, yes. Because there was like a couple random incidents with crazy people doing crazy shit for QAnon. I think someone that crazy, if it wasn't QAnon, it would have been something else. But they take endless dissemination of these polls showing what 5% of people believe in QAnon when 5% believe in anything. And I think it just ends up spreading the idea of QAnon to more people when it's just not a popular belief system.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then the right does the exact same thing with the left. Well, they'll find the craziest people on the left, the craziest kids protesting on some college campus on the left, and they'll say, okay, this is the entire left-wing movement. They'll paint this broad brush with this. And the problem with this tactic is that it makes both the left and the right, their defense against it is to not say, hey, yeah, these people are crazy. They don't represent us. Their defense is to just pretend that those people don't exist. And that allows, in my opinion, that allows both these kind of radical, crazy groups in the left and right to just fester and grow unchecked.
A much more serious question from Magor on Twitter. Ask him if niche internet micro-celebrity has been worth the degenerate fan art. So you've gotten some weird shit in terms of fan art?
So the weirdest thing I think I've ever gotten, and I won't name the person, but... you know, listeners know who I'm talking about. She sent me a giant box in the shape of a penis. Now, this, she didn't buy, she went out and she tried to buy a box in the shape of a penis, but realized there was none that was big enough, right? To just be really embarrassing.
I thought you were going to say she lived in Florida and that had been outlawed by DeSantis.
There you go. No. So she actually constructed giant box.
It's 80 feet long.
And then,
what was it?
And then when you open it up, inside the box, it's like wallpapered with all sorts of, if you're familiar with the term, yaoi art, okay?
Which is I'm going to ask you what it is. There is no way, there is no fucking way I'm going to be happy with what the answer is. That being said, what is yaoi art?
Yaoi art is like this weird, so it's really big for some reason in Japan, especially among women, to like be into gay men, like gay men Japanese anime comics, essentially.
Yeah.
And so inside the box, this giant dick-shaped box, you open it up, is wallpapered with all these pictures of, you know, gay men, not doing anything like sexually explicit, but, you know, like about to kiss, about to embrace, all this like gay anime art, including she had drawn herself very well, mind you, excellently drawn pictures of me and Adam Awesome. in very homoerotic poses. Okay.
Oh my God. You got to send me a couple of those to put in the show notes.
Okay, if you want, I'll send them. I'll send you the whole thing.
Have you found it weird having, I mean, your situation's different because you're, no one knows who you are in real life, but you have fans. Is that weird to have fans?
I guess it is. I don't perceive that I have fans, I guess.
Someone sent you a penis box. You have that. Okay, fans, stalkers.
Yeah, is that a fan? Is that a fan, Jesse? I don't know. I don't think about it. It's weird. I have that problem that I think a lot of people have where, you know, when the negative people attack you, you're like, oh, you know, that's like sticks in your mind. But like you get like 100 positive comments and you just don't even perceive it whatsoever. Yeah. So I'm just a weird autistic person. I don't even perceive that I have fans, or maybe it's because it's all on the internet. It's not like I'm sure if I did a show and every, you know, week there were thousands of people in the audience, I'd have I'd probably be like way more egotistical than I am right now.
Yeah. Last question from Twitter from Adam T. I have very strong feelings about this. I'll let you answer first. Who would win in a fist fight between Jonathan Haidt and Jordan Peterson?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, I'm glad you pronounced Jonathan Haidt's name correctly.
Everyone gets that wrong. Everyone yes. does.
Listen, I'm a huge Jonathan Haidt fan. Okay. Everyone should read The Righteous Mind. If you want to understand politics, you have to read The Righteous Mind. But in a fight, I believe Jordan Peterson is taller than Jonathan Haidt, so I think he's got more reach. And also, like, Jonathan Haidt, he seems like a real nice guy. He seems like a real chill, kind of passive guy. And Jordan, man, Jordan gets up there in that righteous anger. He can get pretty riled up. So I'm going to have to give it to Jordan Peterson.
You know, Jordan Peterson, but not Haidt, has an entry on celebheights.com. I was curious about the height thing. Peterson's 6'1", apparently. Or no, 6 foot quarter inch. Haidt, I've met Haidt. Haidt is not short. It's interesting. This is such a personality thing. Because you're exactly right. Jonathan Haidt, I know this sounds weird, he's a sweetheart. He's the nicest, calmest, gentlest guy. Jordan Peterson has, even as he becomes more emaciated, he has that sort of messianic energy to him. And I can't imagine John Haidt doing well in the octagon against Jordan Peterson. I think it would be a bloodbath, frankly.
Yeah, unfortunately. But listen, they're great friends. This will never happen, okay? This is all just a fairy tale.
Okay, so let's get to the meat of the show. This first segment, it's about a certain group. So, Sitch, I'm going to tell you the name of the group, and I want you to immediately tell me what you think about this group without even thinking about it, just off the cuff. Is that fair?
Gotcha.
In 3 seconds, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Fat people.
Soulless. No, wait. Evil. No, wait. Okay. Godless heathen. There you go. That's my final answer.
I feel a certain affinity to fat people because I'm an aspiring fat person. I've already adopted many of the eating habits of your standard fat person. And I randomly exercise a lot to stave off the mental illness. So once the exercise stops, let's just say I'm half fat already. So this is sort of a story about my people. So what's your understanding of online fat activism? How would you sum it up if we were lucky enough to be in an elevator together for 30 seconds?
Basically, it's the idea that, you should just be happy and you're beautiful at any size. Don't let society say anything about the fact that it's unhealthy or maybe not even attractive to be 400 pounds.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. That was a great elevator ride. And my understanding is, like, it's one of these situations where a group takes some kernel of truth and then blows it up to ridiculous proportions. So it's like, you know, certain diversity, equity, and inclusion projects are founded on reasonable kernels. I know you disagree with me about this, but I think racism is bad, for example. and America has a dark history with race, but then it's like you accept that, and then a few twists and turns later, Nancy Pelosi is kneeling down wearing a kente cloth. And it's like, where did things go wrong? So it seems like certain corners of online fat activism have been in that Nancy Pelosi and a kente cloth moment for quite some time. Do you think this is just like the weirdest corners of academia continuing to trickle down onto social media in adulterated ways and just infecting the minds of 20-year-old slacktivists?
Well, first of all, I've forgotten about the Nancy Pelosi thing, and I can't believe how disrespectful it was to kneel in response to George Floyd. That seems like a really poor decision.
It's like a Katie-style joke. You're filling in well for
Katie. I'm shocked. But no, regarding the fact activism, I think there's a couple things happening. I think a lot of this stuff is sort of the self-improvement positivity, like as long as you have
self-esteem, confidence
movement, you'll be good. Self-esteem, yeah, that's it. Then you'll be good, except I don't think that works because there's this intuition that like we all know like real self-esteem and fake self-esteem, and a lot of the like this body positivity, we all sense that it's fake self-esteem. I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is that everyone right now, the currency to becoming powerful and popular on the internet is victim status. And so everyone's looking for a way to claim that they're a victim. And like a good way is obviously if you're a minority or something to that effect. But if you're not, if you're just like a boring white person and
you're not,
you know, gay or bisexual or trans, yeah, nothing like, you know, if you're not cool like that, then you know, what else you got? Well, you know, fat. Yeah. That's an easy one, right?
Well, and it's interesting. The self-esteem thing's interesting because I don't usually conceptualize having self-esteem as being congruent with I will also melt down if anyone says something mean about me on the internet.
that doesn't seem like fake
self-esteem. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I will say, obviously, there are issues with like the way body image has been presented in the media. And there's these elements of like, to say that obesity is all a matter of willpower is silly. To say that like weight totally defines how healthy you are is silly. The body mass index is like a little bit crude and rough because I think it just factors in height and weight. These are all fair points, but then these reasonable points get blown up to what you're saying, which is like everything is valid, everything is okay. It's offensive to even you know, tell someone maybe losing weight would make them healthier, even though there's solid evidence for that. So there's basically this like super rich, all you can eat buffet of bad ideas circulating in the world of fat activism. And I bring this up because there was this amazing article in the Washington Post headline, "As Obesity Rises, Big Food and Dietitians Push Anti-Diet Advice." Sitch, would you just read the top of this article, if you please?
Oh, I gotta read it? I have to do work for you? Oh my
God. You gotta read it. That's how it fucking works. You're the Katie.
Oh my God, look at this. This is how he treats guests. Okay, let's see. Jay Rockin struggled to lose weight for years, but she felt as if a burden had lifted when she discovered YouTube influencers advocating, quote, health at every size, urging her to stop dieting and start listening to her, quote, mental hunger. She stopped avoiding favorite foods such as cupcakes and Nutella. Quote, "They made me feel like I was safe eating whatever the hell I wanted," said Ruchon, 51, a video editor in someplace in Wisconsin. In 2 months, she regained 50 pounds. As her weight neared 300 pounds, she began to worry about her health. Wow, I'm glad she finally, when she got to 300 pounds, she's like, maybe this wasn't a good idea to just keep eating cupcakes and Nutella, okay?
I feel so bad for this woman, I really do, but... she began to worry about her health at 300 pounds, not 250. It's also just like these fucking influencers. Like, I'm going to listen to the person who tells me to eat Nutella. Like, right. That's just, I can see myself falling into the trap. So the article goes on to explain that these videos are part of this broader anti-diet movement. But now, in a twist no one could have ever, ever, ever seen coming. Sitch, are you sitting down?
I'm ready. Tell me.
It turns out corporations are actually weaponizing the anti-diet movement. How unfair is that?
No! This cannot be true.
This investigation, it was part of a joint enterprise between the Washington Post and an outlet called The Examination, mentions General Mills, maker of Cocoa Puffs and Lucky Charms cereals. Those are two really good cereals, I should admit. The article explains that General Mills, quote, has launched a multi-pronged campaign that capitalizes on the teachings of the anti-diet movement.
What does that mean, Jesse?
quote, "General Mills has toured the country touting anti-diet research it claims proves the harms of food shaming." That's in quotes. "It has showered giveaways on registered dietitians who promote its cereals online with the hashtag Derail the Shame and sponsored influencers who promoted sugary snacks. The company has also enlisted a team of lobbyists and pushed back against federal policies that would add health information to food labels." So I love this because there is such an intersection here of like this weird form of social justice with just corporate bullshit. What does this tell us about the nature of sort of online slacktivism?
Well, do you remember there was a Dove commercial like half a year ago, and they made this commercial, and it was like a video game woman, and she was like fighting a demon or something, and then but it's like film, like it was a CG animated, but it's like film, like she's actually on a set. And then she goes to her dressing room and she takes off her armor and she's like actually fat in real life. and she's like all sad that she's like has to wear this armor that makes her look skinny. And then she goes back out there, you know, as a strong, independent woman, not wearing the armor to be fat, to show that fat women can do backflips over demons and shoot them with laser guns too. And this was sponsored. This was a Dove commercial. And if you like look into it, Dove is owned, I believe, by Unilever, and Unilever owns a whole bunch of these ice cream companies that make all so that awesome. like when you go to the grocery store and you see all like the ice cream sandwiches and all that like pre-made like horrible stuff that's like filled with fat, Unilever like owns like a lot of those brands. And so it does to me just come off as this very cynical attempt to just make it so people will buy their fat, unhealthy products.
Yeah, and then be told they're beautiful. Although if I had... Wait, so she rejected... She had armor that made her skinny and she chose not to wear it?
Yeah, but it like squeezed... It didn't like... It just squeezed it was like a girdle inside. Yeah, it was like a big metal girdle.
I always podcast wearing several girdles, so I
can... As you should. It gives you confidence.
I don't want to read too much from this article, but I found derail the shame to be a fitting hashtag because no one involved seemed to have an ounce of shame. Mm-hmm. Here's another quote. In a TikTok video published in November 2023, the self-described anti-diet dietitian Kara Harbstreet promoted General Mills Big G cereals, which include sugary brands such as Cinnamon Toast Crunch, also delicious, Cocoa Pops, delicious, and Trix, overrated.
Is this sponsored? What's happening?
I will always advocate for fearlessly nourishing meals, including cereal, the Kansas City, Missouri dietitian told her followers in the video, which was labeled hashtag sponsored and disclosed that she was working with General Mills, because everyone deserves to enjoy food without judgment, especially kids. Can you believe that people are shaming their kids and introducing stigma by telling them not to eat Cocoa Puffs 5 times a day? Isn't that awful?
I mean, I think we need to shame kids more. We need to stigmatize kids more. Kids are too soft nowadays, okay? You gotta break their phones, you gotta push them outside, and you say, listen, don't come back until it's dark, okay? And you've collected at least 5 empty needles that you found in the streets from junkies. You gotta build character in these kids.
Right, and quit it with all those weird gender identities. Exactly. When you come back here, I want you to be a boy or a girl, your choice.
You're gonna be a manly boy or a girly girl, all right? None of this in-between stuff.
I'm also fascinated by the way certain forms of online progressivism are so easily co-opted. Like, you'll see these situations where something clashes directly with what had been established progressive orthodoxy 30 seconds ago. So, like, even things like the vehemence of the denialism that Hamas members raped Israelis 30 seconds ago, most of the people pushing that line would not in a million years question the testimony of a sexual assault victim, but then suddenly it's like, no, we're doing the opposite now. It's very it's just very disconcerting, right?
Mm-hmm. So this is a very important point to understand what's actually going on here. There's a big difference between liberals and what we think of as like the classical Democrats left-wing movement and this new thing, which, you know, you can call it wokeness, you can call it leftist, you can call it socialist, which is a very different worldview. And the way you get that seeming hypocrisy between between believe all women and the Hamas situation is that they view the world through this lens of the oppressor-oppressee dynamic. So whoever they believe is the more oppressed person, that's who they have to side with. And when I say oppressed person, I don't mean like on an individual level, because that'd be a liberal way of thinking about it. They're doing it from a group collective identity level. So in America, they're like, oh, well, women are more oppressed than men, so I have to believe and side with a woman 9 times out of 10. But since they view in the Israel-Palestine situation that the Palestinians are therefore the ones that are oppressed, being oppressed by the evil, you know, European colonizers that they consider Israel, which is a racist thing, but that's a whole other story, then they're going to automatically side with them.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I feel like the lefty approach to these issues traditionally was to fight genuinely powerful institutions. So like when I was growing up, we'd hear a lot about how these big ag companies would drown us in sugar and high fructose corn syrup. And there's something about certain forms of identity politics that makes it really hard to do that, that totally disrupts everything. Because like you're saying, everything becomes a matter of these what is going on here? Is it just like I'm a fat person and I have a right to eat whatever I want, and that should supersede any sort of broader sense of like politics? Is it as simple as that?
It's the shift from liberalism, which is all rooted in as us being looked at by society as individuals and having individual rights. It's the shift away from that to this leftist approach that we have rights and should be treated as part of a collective group.
Well, no, but...
And so that's how you gain the victim status.
I know, but isn't part of this, like, saying I should be allowed to eat whatever I want and no one should ever be allowed to judge me, isn't that, in a sense, a pretty libertarian argument?
No, well, it is and it isn't, because they're not making it from a libertarian perspective. They're making it from the perspective of... So one of the things that's very interesting, this is why everyone should read Jonathan Haidt, is that the left and the right have different moral intuitions about things. And so, like, you can have the Democrats and the Republicans, or left and right, they can flip-flop on issues, they can believe the same thing, but they'll believe it for very different reasons. And so, like, when they talk about the pro-fat movement coming from the left, it's not really coming from a libertarian, like, the government can't tell me what to do perspective. It's coming from the perspective of it's harmful for society to push these ideas and judgments and tropes about what makes people beautiful, especially women, beautiful on women, and it's oppressive. And that's why they're kind of getting triggered into that view.
If I eat 4 slices of pizza later today, that's empowering because I'm saying society can't judge me. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because everything, I hate it so much. Everything in the sort of like far left worldview is anti our current liberal society. And so there's like this dumbed down perspective that anything that comes out of our society must therefore be bad and oppressive. So if our society is saying that XYZ is healthy, then therefore it must be bad and we must do the opposite.
Why do... And again, you and I are on the same page, I think, that there are also a lot of normies out there, yes, and it's not all crazy people, but clearly this stuff holds purchase in a lot of institutions and online. Why do you think there's so little concern? Like, if I thought I was a radical leftist, mm-hmm, and I spewed certain lines, and then I saw the CIA was happy to put that on their webpage and their recruiting material, or in this case, General Mills is on board with my supposedly leftist analysis, shouldn't that on its face cause me to question, like, if what I'm saying is like so amenable to corporate interests, isn't that a bad sign that maybe it's not like actually leftist and doesn't threaten power?
I mean, listen, the number one socialist political commentator, Hassan, is a millionaire who lives in a West Hollywood mansion and drives a sports car. Okay. You're asking for consistency. There's no,
I know, but he said he wants to go to Yemen, and I'm sure he will any day now.
Okay. People don't care. They just want a virtue signal. It's all nonsense.
All right. Any other questions about this amazing partnership between anti-diet, fat? Yeah, go ahead.
I do want to say something about the fat stuff, which is like, listen, I'm a skinny person. I've been skinny my entire life.
We've never seen your face or body. And
that's true.
The dick pic only showed a little bit of your body, so I couldn't tell. I'll take your word for it.
Okay. But I don't know. And that's not because I have any magical, amazing willpower. Like, I think it's just because either A, I have a lot of stomach issues, and maybe I literally can't digest food.
Florida Jew.
Right, exactly. Very stereotypical. Or just I eat a lot of protein. I don't eat a lot of just carbs on their own, which I think is one of the culprits that, you know, of the American diet that gets into problems. But I am sympathetic to people that are overweight, because there's a lot of people in America who they're not, like, they get overweight and then they're not even like eating that horrible food and they still just can't seem to lose weight. And I think it's because a lot of people, they get insulin resistance nowadays, and that's not really, we don't really have good like education or understanding of how to deal with insulin resistance. Doctors' ideas about health and nutrition in America is awful. Very few doctors even understand, I would say, proper nutrition guidelines of telling people what to eat or how much of what you eat is actually affecting both your physical health, but also your mental health. And even that, like, once your stomach gets kind of messed up because you're eating a bunch of garbage, your stomach actually, like, there's neurotransmitters in your stomach that actually send information to your brain that kind of make you want to eat certain things that could be unhealthy for you. So on one hand, this is where the kernel you're talking about is, I agree that just, like, attacking fat people and shaming fat people, that's not the solution whatsoever. But there is a way to do it without just saying, listen, you're just beautiful, eat as much ice cream as you want.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, it makes me uncomfortable that we're now in an earnest part of the show, but while we're here, it's also just like, I'm like, I don't know, I do wish I could lose 20 pounds. It's just, it's hard when you're in a food-rich environment we're not evolved to handle, where mm-hmm. it's so brutal if you just, I know calories in, calories out is a little bit oversimplified, but at the end of the day, you do need to burn more calories than you eat to lose weight. And if you compare one fucking slice of glorious, greasy New York pizza with how long it takes to burn that off, I mean, running several miles, it's just, the odds are stacked against you. And it's, yeah, there's people who like are overweight and just can't lose it, and it's not their fault. So again, it's just a matter of the, you know, the difference between racism is bad and kneeling with the kente cloth. So I guess we circle back to that.
Yeah, and you would think that the left should be hypersensitive to, as you were saying, the corporate takeover of this message. When, I mean, I don't know about you, but it feels like when you're eating potato chips that there's some magic there. There's some kind of magical chemical they sprinkle on the potato chips, because you could be completely full. You feel full, and then you eat that potato chip, and suddenly like that full feeling goes away. And you're like, oh, this is not good.
As noted feminist Louis C.K. once said, the meal's not over when I'm full. The meal's over when I hate myself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The only snack that's like that for me where I could just like junk food snack, Cheetos, man. I don't, they're just my fucking nemesis. Okay, that's enough for fat people. I was going to spend the second half of the show shaming fat people, but you just told me not to. Let's do housekeeping, and then we're going to move on to you talking about dumb/smart kids. But first, an ad. You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too?
That's right, that's the sound of selling everywhere, online, in-store, on social media, and beyond.
Shopify POS, no, not that POS, is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory to building relationships with customers and managing orders, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person, backed by everything you need to sell online.
With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock.
Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns, from TikTok, if it's still legal by the time you hear this, to Instagram and beyond.
Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone. Transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution.
Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify.
We should try this with our horrible merch store.
Oh my God, this is good, this synergy opportunity.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/barpod, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/barpod to take your retail business to the next level today. Please help us with our merch. Oh my God.
That's shopify.com/barpod.
All right, housekeeping. We're a podcast, blockedandreported.org. We have, usually I have Katie helping me get through this. You can't, you don't know how to do this. Damn you, Sitch. Let's see.
Everyone should not subscribe and like the Locked and Reported podcast, okay?
No.
They make their guests do way too much work to be on here.
Go to blockedandreported.org. You can become a premium subscriber. There are more than 13,000 of them. It's an amazing community. If you join, you get 3 extra episodes a month. You get early and ad-free access to episodes. All kinds of great stuff. Also, check out our subreddit, blockedandreported.reddit.com. We also appear to have some live events coming up in July. We are keynoting the FIRE conference in Philadelphia. I can't remember if I'm supposed to have said that yet. I think so. We signed the contract. Whatever. And then we're hoping to do a little East Coast mini tour, so stay tuned for show dates there. What else? Oh, Apple Podcasts. We're down to 4.6. Rush over to Apple Podcasts right now. Bump us up to a 4.7. I think that's it for housekeeping. Sitch, we'll let you plug everything at the end of the show.
You had one more thing for housekeeping.
What?
When are you going to be on our show?
Anytime, baby.
Anytime, girl. He says. Anytime. I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay, okay. Not technically anytime. I'm busy. Anytime after April 16th, for real. I would love to do it. Haven't I been
on
your...
We'll see. I'll send him a message. I won't get a response another 6 months.
Look, as soon as I'm done using you for the show, you're dead to me, so it doesn't matter. I've been on your stream, right?
That's true.
So wouldn't I do it again?
Okay.
I'll do sloppy seconds with myself.
Nice.
I don't think I use that word right. Okay, Sitch, you wanted to talk about everyone's favorite subject, math.
Well, you know what I hate?
What's that?
Uppity know-it-all kids.
Okay? Me too.
You tell them, you say, listen, don't touch the stove, it's hot. Don't play in the street, you're going to get hit by a car. Don't, you know, rack up credit card bills on Pokemon Go's and Fortnite dances, because that's what the kids do.
Yeah.
Don't post propaganda for the Chinese government on TikTok and do the kids listen to you?
No.
No, of course they don't. All they do is they call you an oppressor and they start quoting their favorite internet millionaire socialist. So I want to give a big shout out, okay, I'm very, very happy about this, to the city of Seattle for finally putting these smart aleck children in their place.
What do they do?
So I don't know if you heard about this story. But in the city of Seattle, they decided to end the gifted program.
Oh, thank God.
Completely wipe it out. Okay.
thank God. Because a lot of these uppity kids haven't even been living in America that long. And I find that very, very disturbing, just the way they're taking
I
over.
Mean, I wasn't going to say that. You're racist, but okay, sure. But anyway, so in Seattle, they're getting rid of the gifted program completely, okay? And they're going to put all these, quote, so-called gifted kids, they're going to put them finally in the same class as every other kid, okay?
Wasn't there a book about that, Lord of the Flies?
No.
Are you too old to get that reference, or too young?
Lord of the Flies is about a bunch of random boys on an island, and they beat to death a fat kid named Piggy. I don't know what that has to do
because Piggy was too good at math.
So okay. You know what? That makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
So wait, so the Seattle policy, this is a common theme among social justice education types. Advanced math is bad. The thinking goes because there's disparities in who ends up there. Asians mostly. But that's a version of what they're doing here. They're getting rid of it and putting everyone in the same math level.
So it's not just math. They're actually just getting rid of gifted completely. And they're putting everyone together in the same classes. And they're saying that the teachers are going to have to somehow at the exact same time teach the gifted kids accelerated material and teach the normie kids the normal material
at the same time. Is it gonna be like the UN where they all have headsets with like it's all being explained to them differently?
Well, maybe, because actually in the article, one of the articles, the Seattle Times article talking about this, they say that, well, an example of this was that the kids that were that in the accelerated gifted program were on, like, in the class quietly on iPads doing some iPad work while the teacher was reading the story to the quote normal
they're
kids,
doing
or the regular kids. Okay. And like this is the future for Seattle kids that they're gonna
so
have to
wait,
put up
okay
with.
So the teacher's like reading a story presumably about numbers, what is a number, and the advanced kids are like doing differential calculus on their iPads.
On an iPad across in the corner somewhere, you know, like they just throw some iPads at them, say, here, go do some work.
And the idea is that this will somehow make things fairer for everybody.
Well, this is why I say that I'm happy that they're doing this, because Seattle must hate children.
Yeah.
Because now Seattle claims that they're doing this for like to fight racism, because there's too many white kids, too many Asian kids in these like gifted programs. But if that was the case, okay, if it was true that they didn't think that there's enough black and Hispanic kids, you would say, well, then what they should do is they should offer programs or things, some kind of service that would help raise, you know, the educational standards and help raise the test scores of
come on.
So that they could get into the gifted program, right?
Why would they do that?
But they're not doing that. They're just destroying the gifted program and shoving everyone together. So obviously they must just hate children. it's very clear to me. I don't know. Listen, as someone who hates children, I'm on board with this. Okay, this is a great idea.
We always try to give our ideological opponents the benefit of the doubt. And we have concluded... Everyone in the Seattle government hates children and probably wants to do some sort of genocide of all children, if I'm hearing you right.
Well, they just, listen, like me, they probably hate children because they're young and they have their whole lives ahead of them and they're jealous. So you want to just make things hard for them.
I would, I want to get a blood boy. Do you know about blood boys?
No, what is this?
It's like a healthy young man whose blood you take.
Oh, I do know about, yes.
Who's there? It's a famous person who has, not Elon Musk, although I bet, how could he not have a blood boy?
He must.
Part of my own ideological shift, I don't actually think my politics have shifted that much, but I think if you asked me when I was 25, like, who's better at governing or running cities? I'm like, well, obviously the Democrats, they have the right ideas, blah, blah, blah. I see so many counterexamples where I'm not saying Republicans would do a better job, but I'm saying there's got to be a better way than this. And this has now happened in a bunch of different cities, and it seems like such a wrong-headed approach to this really, frankly, difficult problem, which is that kids perform at different levels. And that's it's not an easy thing for schools to fix. I almost feel bad for schools because... You know, kids are in school for, it's been a while for me. How long a day, how many days, how many hours a day are kids in school? So 8 to 3, And if you've got like a chaotic household and you've got shit going on and you've got a single working mom, I don't think schools are going to bring you up to, you know, parity with your more mathy peers. But this surely is not the way.
No, I mean, ironically, so to turn off the cynicism, or to turn it down, I guess I should say, ironically, this is just going to, this is going to increase inequality. It's not going to decrease it, because what's going to happen is that all the kids who have richer parents are just going to pull their kids out of the public schools, and they're going to put them in a private school that still has a gifted program or accelerated courses. And so if you're smart but don't have the money, you're going to be stuck in this horrible system. That, no, by the way, like, I don't see any support from this by any person other than the superintendents of this school district.
Yeah, I think what's what I never get about a lot of these so-called education reforms, I'm lumping this in with like getting rid of standardized testing, although that's now being reversed. People seem so naive about the extents to which rich suburban parents in general will like claw over the dead bodies of their neighbors to make sure their kids have every conceivable right. advantage. Did you grow up in like what kind of, we're not trying to dox you here. What was the general type of place you grew up?
No, I mean, I grew up upper middle class suburban yeah. sort of environment. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I grew up outside Boston in like a wealthy suburb. And dude, it's not just the tutoring. It's like parents basically filling out college applications for their kids, you know, absolutely yanking them out of the public schools if they have any concerns about. I was in private school for 2 years in middle school because in my town, the frankly neurotic parents had decided that this one middle school that like 99% of the world would kill their entire village to get their kids into wasn't good enough. And I had to go to private school for 2 years. And it's just, parents are really, really intense about this. And you're right that any sense that a policy has shifted to make things harder for their kids, they will react to it in a way that'll just drive that gap forward. So like with the standardized testing thing, if it suddenly becomes more about essays, we both know what rich parents are going to do. They'll just hire some like pathetic English grad student to write their kids' essays. There's just no way around the power that rich parents have to do whatever they need to for their kids.
Right. And to me, like, this is, again, more evidence of why I hate the way in which the concept of systemic racism is talked about in this country, because it's like, it goes back to her saying that there's like a kernel of truth and then it morphs into this thing where like, yes, if you want to look at it and say, okay, so why is it that, you know, Black and Hispanic kids are not getting into the gifted program at the same rate as white kids and Asian kids? It probably has something to do with, you know, the history of racism in this country, you know, that goes back for hundreds of years and has put certain communities in bad environments. And that's all true. But the solution to that is very difficult to build people up. That's a very difficult thing to do, but that's the right way to do it. And instead, it's always easier, especially if you're a politician or a leftist, to just tear the system down to bring everyone down to make it equal.
Yeah.
And that's seen as progress. And it annoys me because, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who are on the far left on our show. And whenever I bring up these examples, they say, oh, no, that's like a bad example. You know, I want to take a systemic approach. We need to do all the right things. But that's never what happens. It's always done in this very dumbed down, simplistic way.
I mean, part of that is just that it's hard to actually get anything done in a city, let alone in like the U.S. Congress. So you can understand.
Well, no one knows how to solve these problems.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the issue.
Yes. Yeah, there's a, I looked into this a little bit for my book. I'm far from an expert, but there is decades of research into closing educational achievement gaps, and no one has figured it out. It's also this super sort of essentialist, you know, way of talking about race, where it's basically whites versus people of color, or maybe you'll talk about whites and Blacks and Asians. It just doesn't work in a situation like this, because in terms of things like educational outcomes, there's a huge difference between American descendants of slaves who really have been trapped in shitty positions for generations, shitty neighborhoods, versus, you know, recent immigrants from Nigeria whose kids perform really well and have really good economic prospects. And to just flatten this as being about skin color does not, treat the situation with the complexity it deserves.
No, 100%. And I don't know if you've been seeing this, kind of bumps up against the conversation that Mark Cuban has been having publicly with Christopher Rufo, where they've been kind of arguing back and forth about DEI. And Christopher Rufo, you know, who's saying that the difference that's going on right now is the difference between equality versus equity. And equality meant equality of opportunity. And this used to be the idea that people, especially on the left, are pushing. And now it's kind of morphed into this equity idea, which is the equality of outcome. Yeah. And Mark Cuban keeps kind of denying that that's an idea that exists anywhere. And yet this is a perfect example of it. It's showing that, you know, we've moved away from the equality of opportunity, saying, listen, don't be racist when you're, you know, giving people a test to get into the gifted program. Try to help people as much as you can so they have the same level of access to the gifted programs. And when that doesn't work, you have some politician, some contingency of some political group comes in and says, okay, just destroy it all because everyone has to be at the equal outcome level.
Yeah. Well, I think I haven't read their debate closely, but obviously there's people who are trying to literally impose that sort of weird form of equity. But I think the sort of genuine leftist critique is none of this is actually chipping away at inequality. At the end of the day, rich kids will get a good education, whether it's in a public or private school. They'll end up in good schools. The social hierarchy will remain intact. And no one seems to actually care about that or want to measure ways to make things fairer. So it's just, It's very half-hearted at the end of the day, I think. Although along the way, it will cause some disruption to, you know, lower class kids who have a lot of talent and no longer have access to accelerated classes.
Well, I think there's two groups of people. I think there's like the actual extremists who are the minority who do want to just tear down all the systems because they hate, you know, Western liberal democracies. And they want to just cause as much destruction as possible because they think that the way we teach kids is like to make them racist colonizers. But the majority of people are not that. They're just kind of in the normie group. And I think that those people are just ruled by their typical human behavior. And we saw this a lot with BLM and defund the police kind of movement, where when it first gets talked about, it was like there's a system of racism and policing, systemic racism. You know, I'm not saying that police themselves are individually racist. It's just like this kind of amorphous system. But then whenever a case came up that was a BLM case or defund the police case, it was always people's minds, they can't grasp this idea of like the amorphous system, and they immediately jump to the police involved must be racist. They must have done an intentional racist action. And I think it's the same thing in the schooling thing where they say, well, if kids aren't getting into the gifted program, it must be because whoever's running it is racist. The teachers must be racist. The testers must be racist.
I've never understood that because, like, imagine an oversimplified America where you just had like people from backgrounds like mine on the one hand. They're just two groups, you know, white upper middle class Jews and then descendants of slaves competing for the same educational slots. You would expect kids from backgrounds like mine to be much more competitive just because we have more resources. You don't need racism to explain differences in outcome
exactly,
there.
Right.
And to actually take racism and opportunity seriously, you need to understand. I've never understood this idea that like any – anyway, we're coming dangerously close to mentioning Ibram X. Kendi, and I'd like to avoid that. So let's – anything else on this? We'll include links in the show notes to the coverage so people can read more about the details of this policy. But anything else on this Seattle advanced classes thing?
I mean, listen, I want this contingency of this weird thing on this left, the cancer on the left, to get as crazy as possible so it gets removed and we can have a functioning left-wing party in this in America.
You're an accelerationist.
Again, so. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
All right, so our last subject of the day, I want to end with a bit of a hot take. Do the young people still... Well, you're sort of young. Is hot take in right now? Can you still say hot take?
I mean,
does
it's
that
like,
date me?
It's sort of on its way out, but you can still say. It's still fine.
All right, thank you. You give me permission.
Yeah.
I'm going to lay out a sort of contrarian argument for you, and I'm curious if you agree with it or not. I'm usually not contrarian. I usually just roll with the tide.
Of course.
You guys might have covered this on your show. If so, that's fine. I'm still curious to get your thoughts. So these Vanderbilt student protesters spent what felt like a week just embarrassing themselves as much as they could. Have you been following the story?
I have been. It's pretty funny.
Okay. Yeah. It's undeniably funny. The whole thing started when, as one local outlet put it, quote, students claimed school administrators removed the proposed amendment to the Vanderbilt student government constitution that would prevent student government funds from going to certain businesses that support Israel. So this move is common in the BDS or boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The idea is Israel's doing fucked up shit, so we're going to punish them economically. There's different varieties of it. In some cases, it's just we're going to boycott companies based in the occupied West Bank. I think there's more radical versions of it that really just boycott anything Israeli. It varies. Anyway, kids are trying to strike a blow for Palestinian liberation by having Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, USA, adopt a BDS stance, or the student government there adopt a BDS stance. The administration says no. A group of them rush into this building called Kirkland Hall, where the chancellor's office resides, I guess, to stage a sit-in. The university alleges that a public safety officer was assaulted during this, and there's actually video. Sitch, click this video and describe it for me. There isn't audio, but I'm just curious to get your take.
Okay, let me click this video. See, more homework, but I'll click the video. Okay.
More homework.
Okay, we have a guard who appears to be black. Okay.
Uh-oh.
This is important. He's opening.
This could be a hate crime.
It could be. He's opening a door. There's some students out there who appear to be white students, and the white students appear to physically, violently, like try to get into the building by pushing through this guy. The guy's trying to hold them back, and they're just kind of like a mob of people, a wave of people pushing this guy back to get into the building.
Yeah, this is like a much nerdier January 6th, basically. It's basically the same thing.
Oh, wait, the worst... I forgot the worst part of the video. Oh, my God.
What's that?
At like, you can see that none of these kids wipe their feet, and they're just tracking football. Okay, this is, like, ridiculous.
The real crime is against those tiles.
Exactly.
Yeah, this poor, like, lone security guard is, like, trying to prevent... it's hard to count because they blur out their faces, but...
It's like 30-ish, maybe.
Yeah.
Kids.
Oh, God, they're I didn't even notice that. They're
Look
tracking...
Look at that. They're tracking all sorts of stuff into the building.
Wait, zoom, enhance. I'm trying to look closer at the mud. Yeah, so... the students get in. They do this sit-in, occupying, I guess, the lobby outside the chancellor's office. The cops try... They're sort of allowed to stay there, but I guess they're threatened with arrest if they stand up and go anywhere. They're not being dragged out, at least not at first. It leads to this instant classic clip of one of them calling the police that we have to embed here.
Toxic shock.
Yeah, there is currently a female student who is being denied the right to change her tampon that has been in for multiple hours, which leads to an increased risk of toxic shock syndrome. So while
yes,
you're
ma'am,
saying...
I'm a female, I understand.
If right, so then you should understand... Okay, what you are not hearing, what you are not hearing is that if she stands up to use the restroom to change her tampon, they are threatening arrest.
Ma'am?
So it is not an option for her.
Ma'am, you have an emergency.
Yes, ma'am, I do.
That is an emergency.
Do you have an emergency? Not your friend that's inside. Do you have an emergency?
That is my emergency.
I don't remember the time that I needed to have an emergency personally to call 911 for help.
I'm sorry, what?
I don't remember a time when it has to be a personal emergency for me to call 911 for help. I am requesting assistance, medical urgent assistance.
Okay, what I'm telling you. Okay, so you're telling me your friend in Kirkland needs an ambulance.
She needs...
Is that what you're telling me?
Sitch, what was your response to the tampon clip, as it's known?
I mean, I think it's the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. This is obviously the comedy clip of the year. I'm so happy that this is going on. And, I try to imagine... that, you know, the civil rights protesters in the 60s, as they're getting, like, beaten by cops, as they're getting hit with the fire hoses. I'm trying to imagine them, like, watching some whiny student complain about
shock syndrome
when they're supposed to be protesting.
I also feel, in much the same way I feel bad for the security guard, the dispatcher. She's a fucking 911 dispatcher. She gets calls for rapes and gas leaks. Toxic shock syndrome.
Yeah.
So what eventually happens is some of them are arrested, including a reporter. Most controversially, there was a reporter, student reporter, trying to gain access to the building. He's arrested. The dust settles. But then the kids are basically like, you think we were embarrassing and cringeworthy before? Hold my beer. They're doing the rare move of holding their own beer. And that leads to clips like this.
I was one of the few students who was arrested last night inside Kirkland Hall. I just want to really quickly kind of share my experiences and compare them to what I experienced last night. Again, as people have said, for 21 hours, we were deprived of medical attention. We were deprived of sleep. We were deprived of food, water, resources. And at 5:30 in the morning, I got a pat on my back. I was told to stand up. I was handcuffed and I was escorted out of my own university. I was not told where I was going. I was not told what I was being charged with. It's disgusting that this is how they treat student protesters on this campus.
Shame!
Shame!
I soon arrived to downtown Nashville Police Department. I was taken into bookings. I was processed, and I was released a few hours later. But I want to comment on something. In jail, I experienced better conditions than at Vanderbilt University. I had access to water, I had access to a bathroom. I had access to my friends and the ability to rest. How dare this university deprive us of basic humanity? How dare a top 15, 20 university in this country have more inhumane conditions than that of a jail? It's disgusting. We demand that Vanderbilt reinstate the referendum, that they drop all charges against students that were filed under false pretenses, that they drop the suspensions and harassment from administration, and that they issue an immediate apology to what we experienced over the last 24 hours. Because enough is enough. Vanderbilt is being shamed all over social media. They are being shamed on this campus. They are being set up to be a mockery on the world stage because of how they are treating us. We are saying no more. Keep fighting, guys. Thank you.
Sitch, how do you feel about these kids whose sit-in lasted, I think, 21.5 hours? just the fact that they survived briefly without food and water, this is a testament to the human spirit.
It is. It is. Listen, like, you know, for all the freedoms that have been fought in this, you know, world to end slavery, to get equal rights for women, for equal rights for black people, I think these kids at the top of the list of freedom fighters, you know, and should be held up as martyrs to come.
Absolutely. I think this was the best or worst clip, depending on how you look at it.
It was very clear when we went in yesterday morning that we went, so we stayed and we did not leave. The conditions throughout the day were horrible, as you have heard. We hear a lot about cruelty in this world, from Palestine to Nashville. Our oppressors are the same. They use the same tactics. They consult with each other. They laugh their sick little laughs, and they kill. We were dealing with some pretty evil people yesterday.
So I think I said this on Twitter, but and it's morbid, and I don't want to make light of what's going on in Gaza, but imagine showing this video to a Gazan, like fighting for their life, trying to find enough food. Someone broke the law, was briefly detained, was released, and then because we live in a free democracy, was immediately allowed to criticize the police. They're putting themselves on the same level as Palestinians. So I can't imagine that going over very well.
They would hate, I would hope that they would hate these children for being so privileged. This to me is like, it's the perfect encapsulation, the perfect example of showing how so much of like politics for kids today just is performative.
Yeah.
They want to be able to virtue signal that they were part of some cause and protest, yet they don't want to actually have to deal with like the hassle of, you know, being in a protest, right? It's like, I want to be able to sit in the building to protest Israel, but I want my mommy to come in and give me nuggies and a blanket and right. everything to be fine afterwards.
It's literally like, I'm going to do a legally trespass to do a sit-in. Okay, we'll arrest you. That's not fair.
Yeah, they think they should be able to do whatever they want. It's insane.
Okay, so I'm about to do a total 180 on some of this, but these kids were totally ridiculed across the internet. Understandably so. We're participating in it. The tampon thing is just like maybe the best viral video of 2024, early contender at least. We've talked about this on the show, Katie and I have. What's your general philosophy on ridiculing 20-year-olds and doing what we're doing, where we are, you know, we're spreading these videos, this audio might haunt these kids, and they are 20-year-old kids, and 20-year-olds are by their very nature dumb.
So my thought isn't about like, haha, these kids on a personal level are, you know, should be ruining the day here. Let me take a page out of their book. I'm going to use the collectivist lens here for a second. I think it's good that we as a society shame not necessarily these individuals, but this action, this idea that kids think that they can go in college and instead of like learning to get a job or something, that they can behave in this like super performative BS protesty way where they think they can sit in and cause problems and do all these sorts of student protests and have zero repercussions. We as a society need to basically shame and embarrass those kids so that they stop doing this behavior, because it seems like that's the only way it's going to change.
So to me, first of all, there's this obsession. There's been fights with random literary organizations, with universities, all not taking the right stance on Israel, which frankly has nothing to do with anything. Like if you disagree with U.S. policy toward Israel, it has nothing to do with Vanderbilt University. I understand these kids take like an all politics is local approach. My view is like, you know, if you want to put your body on the line and put your money where your mouth is and occupy the chancellor's office over this, that's fine. And I respect people who hold so fast to their ideals, but you can't then complain when you're arrested. That's like sort of the whole point, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't respect them for this protest because it's stupid. It makes absolutely no sense. As you're saying, what does this university have anything to do with the foreign policy of America? Even though it was about a BDS thing, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a second. But I do think that this idea, this like very performative stuff needs to die. And this idea that kids can do whatever they want needs to die. And the only way it's going to happen, it seems like, is just by making it cringe and embarrassing to do these actions.
So you're not pro shaming individual students, but as like you're saying, as a collective, you're pro-shaming.
We should just mock it relentlessly. So people think twice, say, do I want to go to that sit-in? Otherwise, the video is going to go out and I'm going to look like an idiot.
Isn't the counterpoint that, let's say it was like a protest you took more seriously, a lefty protest over something reasonable, and then conservatives film it and mock, you know, in every group of 200 students, one of them is going to cry and have a panic attack because, again, they're 20. That kid gets mocked. They become the main character of the day on the internet. In that case, you probably wouldn't be happy with the outcome, right?
Well, no, yeah, of course. I'd say, okay, that's, you know, this is was one person in a movement. And I would say that person's actions, I don't think, are indicative of the spirit of the movement. While these kids' actions, I think, is 100% indicative of the ideology of this, like, kind of weird far-left contingency in these colleges.
Okay, are you ready for my hot take?
I'm ready.
All right, so I think this applies whatever your stance is on making fun of hysterical college students, whether at Vanderbilt or elsewhere. My take is basically that this whole thing started because Tennessee actually has a law banning state contracts with organizations that participate in BDS protests. I think that sort of law is ridiculous. It's a complete impingement on free speech. And I think, like, if we're going to make fun of those kids, we should maybe pay some attention to the underlying causes here. I'll get more into the actual chronology in a minute, but first, Sitch, you're not new to this discussion. You did a great video about one of these laws in Texas a while ago.
Bahia Amawi is a Palestinian American who had been working as a speech pathologist for nearly 10 years in Austin, Texas. However, last year, she didn't sign her renewal contract with the state and lost her job. The reason? In her last contract was a line that demanded she not participate in any boycott of Israel while she worked for the state. Yes, in her contract, the state of Texas dictated that an individual citizen could not be allowed to boycott a foreign country. And this wasn't just for spending money on things related to her job as a speech pathologist. But anything. The wording so broad and general, it would mean that if she decided to go to the grocery store and not buy hummus made in Israel for her own personal use, she would be violating her contract. And she wasn't the only one. This contract stipulation applied to everyone in the state of Texas who was receiving money or working for the state. Because Texas passed a law in 2017 making it illegal for the state to pay or hire any business or individual who was involved with a boycott of Israel.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, have your views on these laws changed at all, or are you basically in the same boat?
No, I mean, I'm basically in the same position. I think is wrong for any state to make it illegal for private citizens to not be able to engage in whatever form of protest they want. And I'm actually kind of surprised that this hasn't really been struck down by the Supreme Court yet, because it does seem insane to me. So I'm 100% against these laws in Tennessee or Texas or any of these places.
So what seems to have happened here, like the basic storyline, is that the student government tries to pass this BDS resolution. Vanderbilt administrators basically reach in and get rid of that resolution, like not even allowing a vote, because they claim that if passed, it would violate state laws, given these contracts that exist between the state of Tennessee and the Vanderbilt student government. I'll just read a paragraph from the Tennessean. Vanderbilt administration told the Tennessean in a recent statement that the, quote, student-led effort to pass a resolution proposing Vanderbilt student government adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions tactics did not move forward because of potential conflict with federal and state laws, end quote. The statement said any activity relating to boycotts from the university could make the university, quote, ineligible for new state contracts and could have existing contracts voided, end quote. So I reached out to Vanderbilt to see if I could just talk on background with someone from the Office of Legal Counsel. I didn't hear back, and I don't know the answer to certain basic questions here, such as whether the activist side of the story, which is that the student government is exempt because it's below a certain size as an organization, I think it's like $250,000 a year in budget or something, they claim that Vanderbilt's actually wrong. The administration's wrong. There's no legal issue here. I also don't know if the administration could have just let the resolution go through and then acted appropriately if it violated state law. But my hot take is just that if you're going to devote your limited time and energy to making fun of these students, as we are gleefully doing, to be clear, I feel like you should at least take a little bit of time to point out the fact that the state of Tennessee has a law dictating that it won't do business with people who criticize Israel in a certain way. I think that's blatantly anti-free speech. I also, you point this out in your video, but that doesn't exactly help fight this idea of, you know, these anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Jewish influence, right?
Right. I mean, especially since, you know, it's kind of funny. I looked up the math here. Do you know what the Jewish population of Tennessee is?
5.
You're close. It's 0.3% of the population. Oh my gosh.
Southern Jews.
But as I talked about in my video, these laws don't exist to aid Jews, or not because of Jews. They exist because of the evangelical Protestants, who in Tennessee make up 52% of the population of Tennessee. But no, I mean, I agree. Listen, I don't support the BDS movement personally, but I think that people should be allowed to. We live in America. We live in a free country, 100%. If, you know, regarding like the protest, again, like with the kids, beyond their actual performance being absurd and ridiculous, it doesn't make sense that they're protesting to the college, because the college, my interpretation of the law is that the college is probably correct, that the law wouldn't, they wouldn't separate the student government organization from the college as a whole, and thus the college as a whole would still be violating the law if they allow the student group to do this. And so the students should be protesting. Why aren't they having their sit-in at like their state capitol building or something? Like, isn't that those are the people that create the law that you have a problem with? This, you know, the principal of your college isn't, or the dean of your college isn't going to have any power over this.
Let me do a quick Google search. Tennessee state capitol.
Hold on. I mean, that would require energy and effort and actually to care about the movement, because you'd have to go there.
So I'm checking the distance to a drugstore so they could bring enough tampons. It's just... It's an 11-minute drive from the Tennessee State Capitol. In case anyone's curious, there's a CVS at 426 21st Ave, South Nashville, Tennessee. So, okay. I think it's interesting to draw out our intuitions here, but you think it's not ridiculous to protest this law, but it is ridiculous. It's basically, you're saying it's not the university's fault. It's the state government's fault, as they would say down there.
Yeah, it's not the university's fault, because the university is following the law. Yeah. I believe correctly, even if you disagree with the law, so protest the law. And then also the way in which they handle the protest is obviously so ridiculous.
I realize when you said there's only a few Jews in Tennessee, I realized I'm an anti-Semite, because my mind immediately went to like, oh yeah, they're managing the musicians in Nashville. That's what
I see. So you agree with Candace Owens.
they're the Jews who run the music industry in Nashville.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
All right, that's all I got on tampons and student protests. I almost called you Trace. Oh my god,
who?
I mean, that's a compliment to call you. Tracing Woodgrains is our furry assistant.
Oh, god.
But yeah, I think that that about wraps things up. Where can people find you?
People can find me at the Sitch and Adam Show on YouTube, and they can find me as PSA Sitch on Twitter.
Are you ever going to go back to those time-consuming, less profitable videos?
People every day. Every day.
On the street, people ask you.
Every day, people beg me to do it. And I keep telling myself, and I keep telling them, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do a video. I have a bunch of ideas for videos. I'm going to do it. And then I just don't, but I will. I'm going to do it. Okay, listen, BarPod audience, I will go back. Because it's funny, you said that you want to talk about the BDS video that I made. I watched part of it again. I'm like, wow, I used to be really talented.
I used to be really talented.
You know what? I need to go back to doing it. Maybe you're it, Jesse. Maybe you inspired me to make videos again.
Well, I mean, I would be honored to have played such a role. It was a good video. I respected your ability to not be in favor of BDS, but be in favor of people's ability to do BDS type stuff. So great video. I'll link to that and a few of your other favorite videos. People should check that out. Check out the Sitch and Adam Show. Any parting words to our grateful audience?
Despite all the hard work it took to be on here, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. This has been Blocked and Reported. As always, we are produced with help from Tracing Woodgrains and Jessica the 80s Baby. Thank you one more time. Goodbye, Sitch.
Goodbye, Sitch.
No, you're supposed to... All right, bye.